Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Bunker Show, coming to you live and direct on darkcityradio.com, coming from our secret underground bunker hidden beneath the sewers of Westminster. We're going to be looking into some interesting subjects today, covering quite a broad range. And helping us in the bunker today is a lady bringing us some sunshine down here. Here's Helen.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Really looking forward to tonight's show. Don't forget to come join me in the chat room. It looks like we may have a bit of a chat room split tonight, but if you come in, hopefully you'll see Big Silly Grin, that's me, in the chat room, and Fabris and Dark City, and then you're in the right one with us. And bring your questions, bring your feedback for the show, and I'll get them on there for you.
And also joining us in the bunker this evening is my wingman co-host. Here's Jimmy.
Thanks, Fabrice. And hi, Helen. And hi, everybody out there. Wednesday night, wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
And this evening, we've got an interesting guest for you. Some say he's the medical profession's answer to David Icke. Some say he's more medically qualified than Dr. Judy Wood. Some say he's been down more rabbit holes than Brian Gerrish looking for a common purpose. You may know him as the junior hospital porter that stands against the New World Order, and we know him as Ben Emlyn-Jones. Thanks for joining us on the show, Ben.
Hello, guys. How are you all doing? Thanks for inviting me on, Fabrice. It's good to meet you all.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I've been looking forward to seeing if you could come and give us some medical support down here in the bunker since our very first show when we had Martin Beard on. And like to know is, how did you get started and how would you describe what you do and what is HERPANWO?
Well, HERPANWO stands for Hospital Porters Against the New World Order, because when I first started to become active in this scene, I came across a man called Jack McLam, who was an American who had a group called Police Against the New World Order. So I thought, well, if police can have a group against the New World Order, why not hospital porters? And I was a hospital porter at the time. In fact, I was for many years. And so I thought, right, hospital porters against the New World Order it is. HPANWO, HERPANWO. And so I started with a blog, just writing a blog. And then that sort of blossomed out into, I started another blog. I started putting my fiction online as well. And I started doing YouTube videos and eventually radio shows. So it became a very multimedia experience for me. And that's what it is today.
And how long ago did you start doing your blog? Because I know you've been at this quite a long while, and I think it was way back in 1993 when George Bush gave his infamous New World Order speech. So how long have you been doing what you've been doing?
Well, I sort of had was oblivious for sort of 13 years after that, because I started HERPANWO in 2006. However, I was on the old forum scene before that. Do you remember the good old forums before Facebook came along? And
yes, I do. I remember the Yahoo and Google groups, and before that, IRC and such like.
I still love those old forums. I still got a forum. I keep it going. But I suppose over the period, maybe in the late 1990s, I started to see the world differently to how I'd seen it before. For reasons I'm not entirely sure of, I began to become interested in what you might call the paranormal and conspiracy theory and various other issues as well, including spiritual matters as well. I didn't become a born again Christian or anything like that, but I started looking into the world of various things to do with the idea of God, etc. in various ways. I came from a Catholic family, see, so I used to go to church, but I was then I became a complete atheist for a while, like Richard Dawkins would appreciate, I'm sure. But then I started to see the world very differently, and it sort of built up slowly. There's no one moment when I kind of became conspiratorially aware. It was a long drawn out process involving several different subjects, including UFOs, space exploration, ghostly hauntings and things like that, which I started looking at separately, and I began to realize that these different subjects that I was interested in all seemed to lead in a particular direction. They all seemed to be leading to a particular conclusion, and that's basically, the world is not what I thought it was. And this is a process that's continued to the present day.
Were you a science fiction fan, perchance, Ben?
I was at a time, yeah. In my teenage years, I used to love Arthur C. Clarke.
It's interesting because, you know, like, I think via science fiction, a lot of dystopian futures have already been kind of laid out really clearly. And I think it's interesting to see it kind of play out now.
Oh, definitely. I mean, reading, well, it's something like some of the old science fiction, not just science fiction, but some sort of dystopian futuristic fiction like George Orwell's 1984. And more, I suppose, to a lesser extent, but maybe not quite so, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which was older than 1984. But you see that some of these people are quite prescient. It's almost as if they had insider information. Orwell in particular, I think. Well, Orwell's a member of the Fabian Society, so he may well have had an insider sneak preview, let's say, of what was to come.
Yeah, well, H.G. Wells was a member of the Fabians as well. So, you know, that says quite a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, because that's interesting, because he wrote, of course, books about alien invasion and future worlds in which that basically humanity had split into two and things like this, into two different species, and all kinds of strange things that really sort of like match a lot of what we're talking about now. I mean, Arthur C. Clarke was more optimistic, I think. I used to like Arthur C. Clarke. He was more... his visions of the future were usually quite pleasant and quite... You think, you know, he's going to be all right in the future, you know, we'll get things sorted.
Quite positively aligned, yeah, in the same way that Robert Anton Wilson, another of my favourite writers, is as well. Yeah. So when you start to look into some of those things, Ben, in terms of, I guess, some of the anomalies or some of the unexplained things that happen when you look into sort of spiritualism and some of those sort of almost psychic premonitive events and such like, you often come up with anomalies. And it's, I guess, you spent quite a lot of time looking into some of those.
Yes.
You mentioned UFOs briefly, and one thing that we like on the Bunker Show are questions that stand the test of time and that demand an answer. So, for example, last week when we had David Henke on, we put forward the Peter Heyman, the Cyril Smith, and the Jimmy Savile questions that either somebody knew what they were doing and let it pass, or the systems that are there to protect important people don't work. Either way, there's a national security implication. And you mentioned UFOs earlier, and the Rendlesham Forest incident is very interesting because of the nature of that. And that was where an unidentified flying object or an unexplained aerial phenomenon came very, very close in Rendlesham Forest to two active air bases. One was a British base called RAF Woodridge, I believe.
Woodridge, yeah.
There was an American base as well, which I think at the time, no, it was USAF Woodridge. It was a base with, I think, more atomic weapons than any other, more than Greenham Common at the time. And I believe it was commanded by a lieutenant colonel at the times of the incident, which happened over Christmas in 1980. And it kind of leaves the question, either the gentleman who filed the report, a Colonel Charles Holt, I believe, either he's not fit to be in charge of all those atomic weapons for, you know, making spurious reports, or there was something which came down very, very close to a high security military installation that definitely wasn't authorized. Either way, that has a national security implication. And I know you've looked into Rendlesham Forest quite a lot. What do you think about that Rendlesham Forest question?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, this is one of the best documented UFO incidents in history. And I met Colonel Holt actually a couple of weeks ago. Because he was at an event in Rendlesham Forest, which was part of all the basically historical lecture he was giving. And I think it did occur to him, you know, that he didn't really feel comfortable writing out this report. But yeah, the something strange happened at these twin bases. Now, these were RAF bases, but the US Air Force had a garrison there, which was basically there to store these battlefield nuclear weapons. And there was a massive number of them. And as you rightly said, far more than at Greenham Common. And the Greenham Common was getting an awful lot of publicity at the time because of the nuclear weapons that had been stored there. And there was these huge peace camps that were protesting and trying to put a stop to it. Now, the thing about it is, what Woodbridge Bent was, there was a much larger arsenal of these this ordnance, and it was unlicensed, it was unauthorized. The government had done it without the approval of Parliament. So basically, there was a lot of secrecy surrounding those two bases. Now, it's not uncommon, actually, for whatever reason, for these unidentified flying objects to take an interest in our nuclear weapons capability. I don't know why, you'd have to ask them. I mean, we're talking about, it's hard to put yourself in their shoes, basically, if they have shoes, if they even have legs or feet. But you often find nuclear facilities, you get UFO activity. I myself took a photograph of a nuclear facility once and saw a UFO on the film afterwards when I developed it. But so what happened? It's amazing that, yeah.
Interesting. We had Andrew Johnson on a fortnight ago, and he also mentioned via the Disclosure Project a number of military officers who've been present at those facilities in an official capacity when they've had that kind of incident happen.
Yeah, I mean, this object appeared in the woods, and basically the security police there had to go out and investigate it, and they tell some very interesting stories, as does Colonel Holt, because he actually is, as I said, when it comes to documentation, this guy didn't only write his memo, known as the Holt Memo, which was actually released, amazingly, just 3 years later, but he made an audio recording as well, which you can hear online. It's like a 10-minute audio recording through a dictaphone, in which you hear him describing what he's seeing, and he is seeing what is clearly some kind of unidentified light or an object in the woods, close to ground level, which is visible to him and all his men who were with him at the time. It's actually an astounding piece of evidence. Should we point out, I mean, there's been some talk about how various armchair pundits have come forward to claim that these guys were seeing all kinds of things, a lighthouse, a joyriding ice cream van, that's got to be one of my favourites.
I haven't heard that one before.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, some kids broke into someone's house and nicked an ice cream van and drove it up and down. a truckload of burning manure, which is a big pile of burning manure. it's ridiculous. These were highly trained US Air Force security police. They were carefully monitored. They were carefully screened. Everything about them was controlled to make sure they were doing their jobs properly, because they were in charge of these deadly weapons, and yet they don't just let anyone do that.
Well, I mean, you can tally credible and verified sightings in all sorts of ways. I mean, you can look at the amount of reports or unreported incidences that happen and are recorded with air traffic control, you know, across the world. I mean, can you think of any really obvious incidents that have been recorded by, say, British air traffic control?
Oh, well, interestingly, there are occasions where these things have been spotted. For example, there's a researcher called Nick Redfern, who's a British guy, lives in the States now. His father was a radar operator, and who has actually talked about, he said his dad used to tell him about the strange things that used to appear on the radar scope. Very often they've had visits from, or phone calls from someone high up telling them not to talk about it. In an institution, it's very, very, it's actually surprisingly easy to keep secrets in an institution. I mean, you had a guy on talking about Cyril Smith, Jimmy Savile. Tacit collaboration is actually it's frighteningly easy to achieve.
And can be remarkably effective in a number of ways. I mean, for example when people are talking about information such as this, if there's any way that that information can be disrupted or corrupted, then you know, it seems that intelligence agencies often take an active role, or some groups take an active role in attempting to disrupt that information. Mm. I know that you recently, with the film that you took of Rendlesham Forest recently, and I don't know, have you managed to re-edit that and get that back up? Because
Now this is a sorry state of affairs, because when it comes to the Rendlesham Forest, what actually happens with the Rendlesham Forest incident is that the various witnesses, their stories don't tally. So there's a lot of confusion over what was seen, where it was seen, when it was seen, etc. This began right at the beginning, and so several different witnesses have come forward to tell different stories. And this has led to conflict. This has led to some quite bitter recriminations within the witness groups. And also the researchers who've looked into this have been caught up in the middle of this. And this has included me, because this is the event I was talking about earlier, where Colonel Holt was actually at Rendlesham Forest doing his little tour. I got caught up in this because I was asked to produce a film of the event, because the organizer of the event, John Hansen, he's a friend of mine. He knows, he likes my work. And so he asked me to come and produce the movie. I did, but then somebody else who was there suddenly decided they didn't like it. They didn't like it because I was actually defending one of the witnesses whom he thought shouldn't be defended. And as a result, he decided, with this ulterior motive, he decided to see what he could do to get my video censored. And unfortunately, he succeeded. He actually put in a copyright claim, which is completely false, actually, to YouTube, where I'd actually put this. This is the platform where I published my video. And unfortunately, YouTube agreed to remove the video, and I'm currently struggling to try and get it restored. This was only a couple of weeks ago, so these things move very slowly, and YouTube always tends to err on the side of the claimant, I found, in all these situations, which is something maybe they need to look at their policy about that.
It's a difficult one, because as far as copyright law stands, that actually if you film an event and you make it known that you're filming an event, and it's a public event, then if you wish to make any copyright claim on what you're stating, you have to do so before the event. Otherwise, after it's done. But as you say, you know, YouTube usually err on the side of the complainant. So
that's
hopefully
right.
It won't be too much longer before people can get to see that film. Because
not much longer. I'll tell you what. I mean, I've actually been aided and assisted by a lady called Jilly, who's an expert in journalistic law. She was actually at the event, and she's actually told me exactly what she came across. She went up to the Copyright Designs and Patents Act of 1988, which is the principal piece of legislation that organizations like YouTube will use. And it does state very distinctly in Section 58 that you can't, if you're doing a live speech and someone is filming you, you have to tell them beforehand. If they're doing it openly and they're not doing it secretly, you have to tell them openly, can you please not film? If you can't just allow them to film you and then change your mind afterwards because you don't like what they filmed or you don't like another aspect of their movie. Jilly actually helped me with this. Now, what this guy is doing, who's made the complaint, he's essentially using copyright law as a weapon to silence somebody he doesn't like, somebody he resents for defending a man he doesn't like, which is an abuse of that law, as far as I'm concerned. That's not what copyright law was intended for, which is very, very – I think that's really, really a very bad thing for him to do.
Yeah, I think it's. I think that's why it's very important that actually it's followed through, because it could set a dangerous precedent.
It only goes to show, you know, like any possible weakness in his point, because you know, really, you should be open to debate.
Well, this is what I thought. I mean, I at no point have I ever suggested that anyone else shouldn't have the right to say what they think, whatever version of the story they believe. As for the film, I made what I thought was a very professional documentary, which was respectful to everybody involved, including Colonel Holt himself, even though I did disagree with some of what he was saying, and I objected to some of the things, and the general tone of his lecture I did object to. But I think I did it respectfully, I did it professionally, and I did it in a way that a proper filmmaker would do. And John Hansen brought me into the project because he did trust me to do that, and he said so. He knew my views on Larry Warren, the man I defended, who was one of the witnesses that a lot of the other researchers don't like. He knew my views when I brought me into it, and I did say I will express my views in this film, and he said, fine. I mean, that's what all filmmakers do. I mean, the good news is that I am still working to get the video restored to YouTube, and what's more, I'm going to move it to another platform. There's plenty of other options, including file sharing and client-to-client systems like BitTorrent and things like that. There's plenty of options, which I'm going to work on and get that video uploaded. It's quite a big video, so it might take a long time.
Yeah, I have a copy of it if anybody would like it in the meantime. If anybody would like to drop me a line and I can pop them a copy, because it's worth seeing. And it is a very professional and balanced video, which is why it really should be restored. And it is, it's interesting with some of the clashes that can occur that get in the way, as Jimmy was saying, of being able to take a conversation and move it forward by respectfully debating. One of those things, I mean, do you find that to be a challenge with some of the films that you make, to be able to stay balanced and also be able to genuinely show people what your experiences are?
Yeah, I mean, I find it quite easy, I think, to present both sides, or present my viewpoints, my particular opinions in a sort of professional way. I don't have a problem with that. I've found that no matter what you're going to upset somebody, no matter what you say, no matter what you do. So it's always, I mean, it's unavoidable, and I get hate mail quite a lot. And I think anyone on the internet gets hate mail. That is unavoidable. So I think, I mean, it's just sad because I have no desire to suppress other people's viewpoints. I mean, the situation in Rendlesham Forest is almost universal in this scene, in this conspirosphere, the community, whatever you want to call it. I mean, the man who attacked me has attacked several other people as well. He's sent nasty messages to several other people. We've also got situations with 9/11. Now, you mentioned Dr. Judy Wood at the beginning of your introduction. Now, Dr. Judy is a lady I've looked into an awful lot. I've been to see several of her live shows. I find what she does very impressive. And when I've spoken about this openly, I've been attacked. Mm-hmm. I've lost friends over it. Rather than people saying that, what's surprising is people don't actually, they won't come to me and sort of try and sort of like talk me through it. They'll say things like, "Oh, you're a shill," or "you're spreading disinformation," and things like that. And you are putting people off the truth of 9/11. And so I said, "Okay, so why am I wrong?" And then, boop, they block me.
Yeah. So what's commonly known as playing the man rather than the ball.
Yeah. That's exactly it. And so that's another example of some of the bitterness and complaints, that some of the bitterness that comes through. And I'm not a sort of person who enjoys that sort of thing. I don't thrive on controversy and conflict. I just find myself inevitably drawn into it because there's no other way. There's no other alternative.
Yeah, and do you think that has its own challenge? I mean, one thing that I amazed with Ben is the amount that you do. I mean, you go to a number of conferences every year. You report back on those, which is a great tool for people who don't have the opportunity to go and see those. You also, as you say, you probably have quite a full mailbag in a few ways, and you're also able to produce your blogs and your weekly Hapanmo radio show. So, you know, how hard do you find it to be able to keep your balance? Maybe when you're having people maybe not be so supportive with their energy.
I know. It's tricky. I mean, I say, first of all, that, I mean, I do. I basically attend as many of these events as time and money will allow. And I've been lucky, actually, because I've been given press passes by several people, which means I haven't had to pay to get in because they know that I do these reports. Some of these conferences I've been to are working trips. The last two Basis Project conferences I went to were working trips. In the first one, I did a speech. I was one of the speakers. And the second one, I was the master of ceremonies and a judge in the film festival. So, again, it's kind of like I'm a member of staff, so I don't have to pay. Same with the Rendlesham Forest event.
You mentioned Basis there, and we were talking about a little bit about UFOs and MyLab's military experiments and psychological operations, and those are some of the things that are covered with the Basis conference. So they had their first ever film festival, I believe.
Yeah.
And you know, that sounds like a really interesting project to give quality amateur, semi-professional, and professional filmmakers the opportunity to show their work. So, can you tell us a little bit about your involvement with that?
Yeah, I was selected, or someone asked me if I'd be a judge in the film festival. Miles, who organises it, and I said I was glad to. I was going to go to the conference, and I was very, very keen to go to the conference, and so I said yes. Now, the film festival is, like I say, I think it's the first event of its time, apart from like the EBE awards you get at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, USA. But basically, on the Friday, the conference room was set up as like a cinema, and the films were played one after the other. There were 10 entries. And they were, some were just a few, very short. They were just a few minutes long. Others were over an hour. One was 2 hours, over 2 hours, one of them. And so we went through them one by one, and I made notes. And at the end, we had to, judge which ones were the best. And that was not easy because, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but standards were very high. I liked all the films that were submitted. I mean, Miles selected a few to nominate because he had lots of entries. And I think they were all very good, and I had to pick a winner, and it wasn't easy. And the winners received a beautiful trophy, which was designed by Miriam Janser, who's a Dutch artist. And it's like the Basis logo in 3D on a marble plinth. It's pure bronze. And there was a sort of an award ceremony at the end of it, and we were like giving out, unfortunately, only two of the recipients were there. One of the runners up, and one of the winners. But the winners and runners, the other winners and runners up, are all going to receive their prizes. They've all been informed they won. So, and congratulations to them. It was a great day, that film festival. I loved it.
And what subjects did they cover? What was the content about and like?
Oh, it was centered around the kind of subjects that I think maybe you'd cover on this radio show, which is and the ones I do online. I mean, for example, one young lady called Anna Braga, she made a film about. She made a very good short film, just 5 minutes long, but it was about the fluoridation of drinking water. And it introduced the viewer into the subject very, very briefly and informatively. And it had interviews with activists, because at the moment in Bedfordshire, there's a campaign to stop the fluoridation of the water in that region. So that one won a runners-up prize. And there was another film called Voices from the Gas Fields, which is all about fracking. And it was extremely moving as well as informative, because basically it was about the anti-fracking movement in the UK, but also in Australia, where it's far more advanced. I mean, some areas of Australia have been devastated by fracking already. The entire environment has been destroyed, and the people who live in the areas where this is happening are sick. They are dying, and they can't move out. They can't sell their homes, and their land's dying.
It's quite a shocking film, and that was by Ian R. Crane, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Voices from the Gas Fields.
So that was an excellent film too.
I was going to say, so it'd be well worth people paying that some attention when it comes out.
It is released, actually. It's on YouTube, and You can buy DVDs of it from Ian Stalls when Ian does live shows.
And do you know if the other films will be available soon, or are they already out for people?
Well, most of them are actually already available. Some of them are on YouTube. Others are, you could buy DVDs of them. They're from all over the world. Some of them are American, some of them are British. There's a Dutch one. You get the DVD of that. So there's different ways you can actually get hold of these movies. I think they're all worth seeing, in my view. I mean, I had to pick favourites. I had to pick a runner-up and a winner from each category. But I think they all were pretty good.
And there are quite a number of speakers at the Basis Conference as well. So who did you find engaging over the last weekend while you were there?
Oh, again, the quality of the speakers was also very high. I think there was my favourite speaker was probably a man called Graham Harvey. Now, he talked about farming, and he talked about agriculture and how, you know, there are ways and means of improving it. And I think that's very interesting. It's also very important, because I suppose farming is one of the most important things in the world, because if we run out of food, then nothing else matters. And, of course, food is used to control people as well by the elite, the government, which we've got to get into as well. They actually use the supply of food as a tool of manipulation. And we're living in a world in which farming is basically, most farms are monoculture, which means they just do one thing. They grow one form of crop, or they just have one species of farm of livestock, you know, on their farms in the pastures. And because they're monoculture, the land has to be maintained in a very artificial way, often using chemicals and genetically modified food, crops, GMO crops. Now, what Graham was saying was he showed an old painting of an old field, and he said, look, in the old days, people were doing things very differently. Farms tended to, like, rotate. They were multi-purpose. You would have, like, livestock grazing a pasture while you're growing wheat in one field, and then the following year, what they would do is their manure would enrich the soil, and there's all kinds of different ways in which these animals would enrich the soil, which you could then use for arable work the next year and move the animals onto a different field, and this produced far better quality crops. The animals were much, much healthier and happier. They produced better dairy produce, better meat. And the landscape, the environment was less damaged as a result. So what Graham was saying was, well, that's the solution to all these problems. You don't need genetic modification. You don't need all these various pesticides that are killing bees and things like that. You could produce a perfectly good farm yield by going back to this old mixed farm process. And something we talked about off stage, which is very interesting. He didn't mention it while we were on stage. There's something called terra preta. Terra preta comes from the Amazon rainforest, and it's a very, very fertile soil, which believes was created a long, long time ago by the civilizations that used to live in the Amazon basin, which has long since died out. They were killed by disease when the conquistadors arrived. But the terra preta is still there, and there's movements to synthesize it. Now, terra preta, if you had terra preta on a farm, it can increase the yield of the farm a dozenfold with no environmental impact at all. In fact, it's very good for the environment. So I think he was probably my favorite speaker. But again, I hesitate to pick out a number one out of the pack, because they were all extremely entertaining and extremely informative. And I'm very grateful to everyone who came to speak there. And some people travel a long way. We had a guy coming all the way from Germany. We had an American bloke who flew over. It was really incredible, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, that does sound like an interesting conference to
recommend
to attend. Yeah, and also, as you are mentioning, the use of farmland in a different way, and using the community, using the environment in which you live in a more productive way. A lot of the work that you do obviously spans the nation, but I know that you've also been involved sort of locally with local projects in your community. Did you work with a local co-op for a while?
Yeah, an organisation was set up called the People's Supermarket, which is a small local business in which you can actually join it and become a shareholder of the business. And if you do that, if you buy stuff from the shop, you get a discount from it. But you're expected to work there as well. So you shop there, but you also work there. So you're both shopper and staff. Mm-hmm. And I was involved in that. Unfortunately, it only lasted for a few months, but it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful because it took away a lot of the stranglehold that some of the big supermarket chains have on us. Because as is the case anywhere in the world now, big international corporations are trying to take over the retail sphere, and small local mom and pop shops, as they call them in America, are suffering because people are bypassing them and going to the bigger, cheaper, with bells and whistles on it, the big Walmart or Tesco's or whatever it is down the road, which is a shame. The People's Supermarket was an attempt to fight back by creating a retail outlet in the local community, run by local people, which was profitable and could reduce its prices to the point where it could compete with these large corporations. It was only about one day a week I worked there. Sometimes usually half a day a week or something. Sometimes a bit longer. But I was extremely proud to be a part of that. And unfortunately, through some misfortune more than anything else, it folded within a year. One of these problems was that there was a big fire next door, so they had to shut the road off.
That doesn't help if people can't get to actually use the People's Supermarket. But
it'll come back. There's plans to bring more. Sorry, Fabrice.
I was going to say, do you think those projects are really valuable to the community, and that it's worthwhile when you find those people to engage with the community in that way?
Extremely. I would recommend to anyone, please, when you're doing out shopping, I know it's tempting to dip into co-op or to Tesco's or Sainsbury's and pick up the 90p loaf of bread, all right? But if you spend just maybe another 10 or 20 pence, you're in the little corner shop, you know, the little corner shop with the guy behind the counter with the white coat on who says, "Good morning, sir, good morning, come in," and things like that. You know, if you do that, you're investing that money in the local community, in the local economy, rather than having it sucked out and dumped into the pockets of huge corporations. And then they say they put the money back, but they don't. They just give people slave labor jobs. They bring in people on job seekers allowance to work there and things like that in Tesco's and places like that. And so please do consider that when you're out shopping. Really, please do try to use the small local businesses, even if it costs you a few more pence. In the long run, you see, the more people who use these small shops, the higher their profit margins will be, and then they can reduce their prices. And if you find something in your local area like the People's Supermarket, which you can join, and you can actually, it's like a sort of cooperative business, then please do join it. Get involved. Please do. Because that's the sort of thing that changes the world.
I couldn't agree with you more there, Ben. And in terms of actually what some of the things that you do to change the world, one of them is your radio show that you do each week on Panmure Radio. And one thing that you do there that I absolutely love is your Panmure Space Weather. Can you tell me how you came up with that and what that is, really?
Right. Well, yeah. Well, basically, I'm actually very similar to you guys. I run a radio show, a weekly radio show, on the internet, and it's called the Hopanlo Show. I mean, I have several other radio projects I'm involved with as well, but this is my own production. I like to bring on a guest every week. I like to play music as well, and give out news stories and things like that. But also, I have this segment which is space weather. Now, space weather is like the normal weather. It's like reading out a weather forecast, but it's basically things in space. Space weather is basically anything out there in space that affects the Earth. So this is things like solar activity. it's things such as meteors and comets, which can have an effect on the Earth, and solar storms and things like that, and the moon as well. The moon has a big effect on the Earth, depending what phase it's in, and it has effect on tides, and how dark it is at night, and things like that. So that's basically, so I thought, well, I'll do that, because that's a bit more, it's a bit more sort of involved, it's a slightly sort of like, it brings the listener's interest into a larger space, do you know what I mean, rather than just reading out the weather. It makes them aware of the whole world and what's beyond it, which of course is a big interest of mine, because I'm interested in space exploration, and of course, unidentified flying objects.
And again, it's something that engages people, because as you point out, if there is anything interesting in the sky, or if there is anything interesting going on, have you ever thought about? I know one of you. Have you ever thought about sort of doing a geological weather forecast or Earth forecast? I'm not sure that's the right sort of thing, but in terms of sort of earthquakes and tremors, I know we don't get too much activity here, but have you ever thought about something of that nature?
I'm not sure I'd have time to do both, but it's a good idea. That sort of thing is a good idea. Yeah, Earth weather, I suppose you call it, or underground weather, or something like that. I think the fracking issue would come into that as well, because of course we don't get, in this country we're lucky, we don't get much natural geological activity such as tremors, which of course can be extremely destructive, kill people in vast numbers. But we do have the risk of fracking hanging over our heads. And Blackpool, for example, recently had its first earthquake in 110 years. And coincidentally, no one pretended it was coincidental. I thought someone was going to. It happened just when the test fracking well was drilled, just a few miles away. So, geologic forecast plus fracking days. That's a good idea, actually. I'm not sure I've got time to do it myself, but...
Because you get around you get around quite a lot. I mean, you could even... one of your films, I think you did it just down the road from where I am when I'm not in the bunker, in Brighton, on the newspaper report about the time space portal.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that? And actually, maybe you're working to Helena Duncan as well.
Yeah, I can. Well, those are quite similar events in a way, because now the Brighton situation was very interesting, because I came across a news report which was, it was presented on TV and it was presented in a newspaper as a novelty story, a kind of a joke story, because it appeared in the Metro. And it was on a TV program. And it talks about, what it said was that a lady had been out walking her dog in Brighton, and she'd come across an interdimensional portal. That was a vortex was her exact words. And she was very concerned because, she worried she might lose her dog. Her dog might get sucked into it. And so she reported it to fixmystreet.com, which is a website which deals with, basically, as it said, reporting faults in local government services, for example, street maintenance. But also for things like broken street lamps, dustbins coming loose, and things like that. And so she reported it to that. Now, Brighton and Hove Council said they weren't going to take any further action. It's hard to know exactly what action they could take. But I mean, I was reading through this, and I thought, let's check the source. So I checked the source article, and it was actually from the Brighton and Hove Argus, which is the local paper down there. And it was written by the crime reporter of that newspaper. So, very odd. I mean, this journal, which is has different themes and different pages which do different things. They got the crime reporter report on what she was saying. And I read through it, and it didn't have the tone of a novelty article. It actually sounded quite serious. So I thought, I'll take my camera down there and I'll investigate. And I basically got on the train, went to Brighton, and found the place where it happened. And so I had a look round to see if there was anything unusual. And what made me think that there might be something unusual is the idea of interdimensional portals is actually, firstly, it is actually quite a plausible one. And secondly, there's another area not far away from where this happened, which has already developed a reputation of being, shall we say, connected to things out of this world, and that is Clapham Woods. There's been several books written about Clapham Woods, and they describe sometimes quite alarming situations, the presence of strange non-human animals and creatures. And this lady from the Hanover in Brighton, she actually said she made two reports to Fix My Street. The second one said, I walked down there the other way and the interdimensional portal is still there. And I saw a snake coming out of it. And I thought, well, that's odd. But then things, people who see into other dimensions, whether it's in this way or people sometimes who, for instance, the Amazon Indians who take particular drugs to get them into a trance state, they see snakes as well.
It's interesting you should mention Clapham Woods, because I've been there when I was younger, and in the late 80s, it was known because there are areas of the wood that animals wouldn't sing. And on one occasion there, I came across animals that had been decapitated, and a circle that had been etched into the ground, with a very, very unusual feeling about the place. So its reputation is somewhat warranted.
Yeah, I mean, there's the people who study it actually say, don't go around there on your own, and, you know, be careful when you go in there, take people with you, things like that, because it is actually unsafe in the views of some people, because it's such a powerful area, because the activity is in there is so common and so extreme. And I take that sort of thing very seriously. I think it's
Well, for those people who are aware of ley lines, it sits on a triangle in the middle of a triangle of local leys.
Mm. Yes, yeah, and those several books that you mentioned, they cover off on some of the bizarre ritualistic behaviour that occurs in the well, that is reported to occur in the woods. So it has quite a reputation here. It might be worth your investigation.
Oh, definitely. I'll have to go down there sometime, but I'll do it with caution.
Yeah, there's some interesting books. One's The Demonic Connection by Toyn Newton. I'll see if I can pass you a copy of it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's for Helen Duncan. You mentioned now Helen Duncan's situation. I'll have to go through this quickly because we're almost. I know what the time is, but Helen Duncan was a psychic medium, and she was a very, very powerful one, and one which. Well, she was a materialization medium, which meant she produced ectoplasm and things like that. And what happened was in the 1940s during World War II, she was arrested and tried in a very, very suspicious case, which became known as the witchcraft trial. And the witchcraft, it was very, very odd, because you'd think, you know, she in those days they did give mediums a hard time. They did that. There was a prevailing view that they were all fake, and if they were caught doing what they did, they could face fines and maybe short prison sentences. Helen Duncan was taken to the Old Bailey. She was actually tried in the Central Criminal Court under the Witchcraft Act of 1735, a law over 200 years old that hadn't been used for over a century. They said basically someone wanted to put her away because this law left someone with 9 months in jail. So basically someone wanted her out of the way. And they dusted off this ancient piece of legislation that basically crowbar her into jail. And the reason they did it was because she, through her skills, through her psychic powers, was giving away secrets, wartime secrets, classified information from people who died. For instance, sailors on ships that had sunk would actually come through in her seances.
Yeah, there was one incident of that where the government had kept a large battle cruiser that had sunk secret. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. There were two occasions when the government did this. The first time it was HMS Hood, which was an Admiral-class battlecruiser, the biggest and most powerful ship in the fleet, was sunk by a German battleship. And the morale was very low because this was back in 1941. We just had Dunkirk and the Blitz was going on and people were dying and everyone was very, very pessimistic about the outcome of the war. So the government said, well, let's not dampen anyone's spirits anymore. Let's just keep the loss of the Hood secret. And it was very easy. It was much more easy to do in those days than it is now because they didn't have the communication. But Helen was actually at a seance in Portsmouth, and a young man appeared in his square rig, in his naval uniform, and he addressed the crowd and said, I'm a sailor who's on board HMS Hood. I'm afraid I'm dead. I've drowned. Now, of course, skeptics will say, well, she was fake. It was just a big charade. But then if it was such a big charade, why did the government go to such effort? They took it very seriously. They went to enormous effort to silence this woman. And they did it. They, in doing so, they committed a terrible injustice against her.
Well, they used it, as you said, it's a 200-year-old legislation. And is there a campaign at the moment that's seeking to in some way address that?
Well, there's the law, the Witchcraft Act has been repealed, as have the Fraudulent Mediums Act. So there's no, luckily it's not a contemporary issue. But there is a campaign to pardon Helen Duncan. Helen died in 1956, so this was a long time ago. But there's a campaign to pardon Helen because of what happened to her and get her name cleared. And it's been led by a lady called Margaret Hahn, who's a good friend of mine from the United States. And she's also Helen's granddaughter.
I was going to say, that sounds a really appropriate thing to do after so long, because it's, you know, even if people are experiencing non-local communication that people can't necessarily explain off the top of their head, that's no reason to put people in jail for, you know, archaic reasons.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we get Helen pardoned, I think it will be enormous. It would be an attempt to heal the injustice. I mean, Maggie and Helen's supporters, they say Helen is still in touch. Helen is still communicating with people from the other side. And I think she would appreciate that. But also it could lead to maybe further disclosures about other subjects. Because I think there's a bigger secret attached to this. There's a bigger issue at stake.
One of our chat room listeners has just said that...
I'll just read it out to you. Helen Duncan was screwed by her barrister, who was not a practicing criminal barrister, Charles Loseby.
That's, unfortunately, Charles Loseby was not actually, he was not a criminal barrister, no. He was a solicitor who was a supporter of spiritualism, and he meant well. He wanted to do the best for her, but he made some fatal mistakes. And it's probably not time to talk about that in detail, but I feel sorry for him, really, because I think he didn't want to do any harm. But
It would be an appropriate one to see if people can get justice or some form of justice by supporting that even in the next century.
Absolutely.
Well, we're almost drawing to the end of the Bunker Show, Ben. Could you let our listeners know where to get hold of you and your work?
Sure. It can be found at my website, which is www.hpanwo.blogspot.com. That's Hospital Porters Against the New World Order. That main website is also a portal to all the other things I do, the Hapanwo TV YouTube channel, the radio show, and the fictional blog and the forum and everything else I do. I'm appearing at several live events as well, so if you check the conference circuit, you'll probably bump into me at some point.
Okay, that's great, Ben. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you also to our listeners. Thank you to Helen in the chat room, who also, I think, has...
I was just going to say thanks to everyone in the chat room. We've had some of our regulars tuned in tonight. And we've also had John Walson, who also was at Bases, who won the amateur short film category with his film Fight for Justice. So he's been joined us in the chat room tonight, listening to the show.
Well done, John.
And thank you for your contribution. He did. So I just wanted to say that and say hi to Sarah and Peter and Jono and all our regular listeners out there. Thanks for joining us.
And I'd also like to say thank you to everybody who shares our flyer, who sends us messages of support and suggestions for how we can help the Bunker Show. Jimmy.
Cheers, Ben. And I'd just like to quickly say I love listening to your show. Your voice is very soothing, you're very chilled out, and your music selection rocks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's really good of you. And I've really loved being on the show. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure having you, and we've got some more entertainment here on Dark City Radio. We've got Martin, Edward, and Sarah. Martin, Edward, Sarah, and Bob after their cracker of a show last week with Jason Reed from Leap. This week they're going to be giving out growing tips for the hobby grower, caregiver, and anybody else who's interested in that form of horticulture. Following that, we've got the Captain Max Steele show, and that's on Free Energy. Hopefully Max is feeling better, as I helped cover his show last week. So if you'd like to listen to the podcast where I was talking to Vinnie Eastwood for a little while. And all that remains is to say, see you next week.